Chapter 5. Tommy. An adventure entered into with a sense of civic duty and professional obligation ends in the bitter taste of abandonment, disloyalty, and salted airline peanuts. Just before the Girls tour, Heather and I caused the downfall of one of the country's biggest fucking coke dealers. And it was all because we didn't want to go to Jamaica alone. Our manager, Doc McGee, had a lot of suspicious friends who lived in the Caymans. They were these crazy, macked-out guys with only first names, Jerry, Lay, Tony, and they'd bring huge fucking suitcases full of coke and cash to the island, where they'd launder their money without the IRS getting up into their shit. Lay, a tan, suave, filthy, rich southerner, was one of the coolest of Doc's friends. I had originally met him with Vince when we were chilling in the Caymans. Lay walked into Doc's rental house with an attaché case, and the first words we spoke to him were, "Gimme, gimme, gimme," because we knew what was in that fucking attaché case. Mountains of white powder to stuff up our noses. Lay opened the case and gave us a little rock. "That's all you're giving us?" Vince yelled at him. "I'll tell you what," Lay said. "If you can open the case, you can have more." And with that, he gave us a knowing wink, shut the case, dropped a lock clasp, and spun the combination dials so we couldn't open it. We had that entire rock in our system in 10 minutes, and then, as always happens when you're high on coke, we started fiending hardcore for more. Vince and I grabbed the suitcase and tried every single combination. We were so coked out that we actually thought we were coming up with every single permutation of three numbers. "Wait!" Vince would yell in a flash of inspiration. "Have we tried 666 yet?" Finally, I went into the kitchen, grabbed a butcher knife, and cut the top of Lay's $1,000 leather briefcase. Glittering inside like white gold were fucking dozens of huge plastic bags filled with coke. We slit them open and just dove in like we were bobbing for apples. After an hour of white heaven, Doc walked in. "What the fuck are you doing?" Vince looked up at him, his face white with coke and slobber. "Well, Lay said we could have it if we opened it. And we opened it." Doc was fucking pissed and kicked us out of the apartment. I think we ended up paying for all the drugs we destroyed out of our royalties. Not long after that, Lay got busted. He used to have super hot chicks fly in to meet him in the Caymans for a few days, always different girls coming two at a time. And we just thought that he was a Mac fucking daddy. But the truth is that he was using them as mules to bring drugs into the U.S. One time, these killer blondes came down from New Orleans and kicked it with Doc, Lay, and the guys from Bon Jovi, who Doc was also managing. When it came time for the girls to leave, Lay taped drugs all over their bodies and dropped them off at the airport. It was their first time smuggling, so one of them had the bright idea of duct taping scissors to her body. That way, if she was in danger of being caught, she could just cut the drugs loose. Well, Einstein and her friend went through the metal detector, and of course, the scissors set it off. They searched her, found the coke, then searched her friend. It's a small island, and they knew the girls were with Lay and the Bon Jovi guys who had left the island on the previous flight. So they made the plane Bon Jovi was on turn around so they could search everyone's luggage for drugs. Then they sent cops looking for Lay, who jumped on his jet and went into hiding on another island before they could catch him. And that's when Heather and I came in. We wanted to go to Jamaica, but we didn't know anybody there, and Lay, of course, was connected to fucking everyone in the Caribbean. So we had Doc get in touch with him, and he said he'd meet us in Jamaica to show us around. Unbeknownst to him, however, the feds had made a deal with the Jamaican government, and the second his plane touched down in Kingston, they surrounded it, pulled him off, put him on a jet for Tampa, and arrested him there. Heather and I felt terrible. We had no one to show us around Jamaica. Shit turned out cool for Lay, though. He got sentenced to life in prison, sent us a couple letters, and then we didn't hear from him. Next thing I knew, when we were in Tampa on the Decade of Decadence tour, Lay was at the show, decked out in fucking Armani. He wouldn't tell me how he weaseled out of a life sentence in less than 10 years, but he did claim that he was keeping his nose clean. By then, I was keeping my nose clean too. So was our manager, Doc McGee. Before he met us, he was living a secret life that blew up on him when he got busted for helping smuggle 40,000 fucking pounds of pot from Colombia into North Carolina. It wasn't his only bust, because he was also being accused of associating with some well-connected madmen who had conspired to bring over 500,000 pounds of blow and weed into the United States in the early 80s. So, just as we were going through rehab, the law slapped Doc with a $15,000 fine and a 5-year suspended prison sentence, and made him set up an anti-drug organization, the Make a Difference Foundation, after he pled guilty in the North Carolina case. Doc knew that anyone else probably would have been in jail for at least 10 years for that shit, so he had to do something high profile to show the court he was doing the world some good as a free man. And his brainstorm was to commemorate the 20th anniversary of Woodstock with the Moscow Music Peace Festival, a giant spectacle of sobriety and international love that included us, Ozzy, the Scorpions, and Bon Jovi. All the money was supposed to go to anti-drug and anti-alcohol charities, including the Make a Difference Foundation. But it was all bad from the moment we stepped on the plane. We had a pact as a band that we were going to stay sober. And as a sober band, we were going to take our music to the fucking top. Dr. Feelgood was coming out in a couple weeks, and Doc told us that a warm-up show in Moscow would be a great way to kick it off. He explained that everyone would be equal on the bill. There would be no headliners, and everyone would play a stripped-down 50-minute show with no props or special effects. The running order would be the Scorpions, Ozzy, us, and then Bon Jovi. But as soon as we stepped on Doc's plane, which was covered with stupid psychedelic hippie paintings by Peter Max, memories of the theater and girls' tours flooded back. We were looking at a day-long plane ride with absolutely nothing to do. Then, there was a so-called doctor on board who was plying the bands who weren't sober with whatever medicine they needed. It was clear that this was going to be a monumental festival of hypocrisy. Even Mick was in a shitty mood the whole flight. He had been helping pay for all our drug problems for a year. Now here he was, flying to Moscow to help pay his management, the guys who were supposed to be taking care of us, for their drug problems. When we arrived at the gig, it started to become clear that this was a total clusterfuck, and Doc had told each band something different in order to get them to do the show. John Bon Jovi thought it was just another stop on his world headlining tour, while we thought it was supposed to be a small-scale, reduced set. Then the production manager broke the news to us that we'd been demoted. We were on before Ozzy and the Scorpions. I was fucking livid. Doc was supposed to be our manager, looking out for our best interests, and he was favoring one of his newer clients, Bon Jovi, over us, and the Scorpions, who in Russia were massive. "Fuck you, Doc," Nikki said to him. "We didn't fly all the way to Russia to be an opening act while Bon fucking Jovi gets to headline for an hour and a half. What's up with that?" "Dude, we are fucking going home," I screamed at Doc. I was pissed. "This show isn't even about us. It's about Bon Jovi." "You guys can't do that," Doc pleaded. "That's fucked up." "Hey," Nikki said, "we're not doing anything wrong. You told us something that wasn't true. You said that everyone was supposed to be equal on this show, and now every band is getting more time than us. This is turning into a fucking joke." Finally, Doc appeased us, and, more out of respect for Ozzy, who took us on tour with him when no one knew shit about us and was now playing with our friend Randy Castillo on drums, we said we'd do it. We played a decent show the first night, and it felt good to be busting out Dr. Feelgood and Same Old Situation live for the first time. Ozzy was fucking crazy and great as usual, and the Russians went ballistic for the Scorpions. The audience, which was about 125,000 people, started to stream out of the theater after the Scorpions, but then old John made his grand entrance right through the middle of the audience as lines of Russian police officers split the crowd in front of him like the Red Sea. As soon as he reached the front, the whole stage went boom! Fireworks and flash pots and pyrotechnics exploded into the air. The crowd went ape shit, while I fucking shit in my pants. You need to get permits to get those kind of pyrotechnics into Russia. And it was clear that Doc knew all along what Bon Jovi was planning for its show. So, as soon as those bombs went off, everyone in the crew and other bands looked at us. They knew that someone was about to get hurt. I hunted Doc down and found him backstage. I walked right up to him and pushed him in his fat little chest, knocking him over onto the ground like a broken weeble. As he lay there, Nikki broke the news.
"Doc, you lied to us again.
This time, you're fucking fired.
We did the honorable thing and played the next day. Then had our tour manager book us a flight home on Air France. We didn't want to have anything more to do with helping Doc pay his legal bills. We flew back via Paris and New York and talked with Doug Thaler about ditching Doc and helping him start his own company to take care of us. The whole ride home, we felt like suckers for even going to Russia, but also like dumb fucks for dumping our management on the eve of releasing the first record we ever really felt pumped about. I hold myself up with Heather, just depressed and fighting the urge every day to make a big to-go order from the liquor store. I did interviews, I listened to the radio a little, and I could feel maybe a little momentum growing, but I had no idea. Then, on October 3, my 27th birthday, I received a fax. It was from Nikki. If you could have just one thing on your birthday, some way for the world to say that it will all be okay, then I would wish for you with all my heart a number one album on the Billboard chart. Happy birthday, Tommy. You have a number one album. I drove to the newsstand, bought Billboard magazine, and had the album chart shellacked and mounted. Then I called everyone I knew.